You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Jessamyn Lovell. Jessamyn, thanks so much for being with me today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Jessamyn, we're going to talk about your work. We're talking November 19th in 2020. You're in New Mexico. I'm in New Haven. I want to talk about your current work, but to give some context to the listeners, let's talk about a past project of yours before we talk about the current work. Dear Ehrenhardt, can you tell me a little bit about how that project started and what it is? I think it's fascinating, and I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, sure, certainly. The project started, it's kind of a long story that I can make very short, is I was traveling back to San Francisco from my new home in Albuquerque, New Mexico in 2010, I would say. And I think that's right. And I was installing a show at San Francisco Camera Work Gallery about my father. I had been following my estranged father for a couple of years and was making an art piece about it without him knowing. So it was kind of a big deal.
But by following your estranged father, just to be clear about that, you were following him, meaning the way a detective or a stalker would follow somebody, and you were photographing him?
So definitely not like a stalker, per my legal advice. Like an investigator or paparazzi is a good, I use paparazzi law as a guide.
Okay.
So all within the legal bounds of California state law, and did a lot of research to understand how to do surveillance and explored a lot of the ethics around it with that particular very personal case, I guess I can call it now, art piece.
And you're becoming, in your research on that, are you also becoming a licensed detective or something like that, private investigator?
Yeah. Yeah, so that came much later. So yes, after Dear Ehrenhardt, I did end up becoming a private investigator, and I am a private investigator currently practicing and licensed in New Mexico.
Okay, but it came out of these projects, of course. So yes, yeah, so sorry, I interrupted you to interject that. But you were working on that project with your estranged father, and then
led to me installing the show, and then my wallet was stolen out of the gallery as I was installing the show. So it kind of like dominoed then, where the wallet was stolen, the whole purse with the wallet, the phone, that whole thing. I'm sure most people listening have experienced something like that. And so I went through the process of getting my things replaced, and I got a new license in New Mexico, came home obviously, and about a year later, I got a call from a detective in San Francisco asking if I knew a woman named Ehrenhardt and did I allow her to use my license. So obviously the answer was no at the time, but I did get to know Ms. Hart really well in a similar fashion to the way I got to know my father from a distance. And sort of as a surveillance investigator using surveillance to follow. For Ehrenhardt, it was more about tracking. I mean, my dad was easy to find and, frankly, pretty easy to surveil without him knowing. Whereas Ehrenhardt, it took me several years of trying to find her, track her down. But because she was such a, you know, skilled hider, I'll call her, she was very good at hiding and sort of getting out of the way of whatever, you know.
But what had she actually done initially? It was that she had tried to use her license, but is that identity theft? Like, had she gone?
Yeah.
What else happened with that? That's the definition of identity theft, trying to use it, but had she also bought things or somehow established another identity?
No. She used my license in a really kind of simple way, actually. She didn't have any of my other information except what was on my license, obviously, and she had a sort of a resemblance. She was a couple years older, so she was able to go to, so for instance, there's a very long list of things she used my license for, but for instance, she went to Hertz Rental Car Agency in the San Francisco airport and rented a car, was able to rent several cars using my license and my name and my address with someone else's credit card. And so at that time in 2010, 2011, you were still able to do that. I actually don't think you're able to do that anymore, but you can just present your license and then have either someone call in a credit card or use a credit card number. And so she was using a man in Texas's credit card number without his permission, and then using my license to represent her. And so she was able to rent these cars, I think it was 3 cars in total, different cars, and then get all kinds of parking tickets and, you know, damages that Hertz was charging me for. So that was one of the things. She also was able to, or she was trying to check into a hotel, a very fancy hotel on the Embarcadero in San Francisco called Hotel Vitale. And I went there and learned a lot about her attempt at residing there with my license and this man's credit card. And so
because you went there and then began talking to the people as an investigator.
So I just want to clarify that the reason I know all these details is not your typical identity theft story. Like, just someone learning that their identity was stolen, it doesn't come with all this information. And I really want to make that clear, that that was a sort of a privilege I was able to negotiate and navigate in my project, being, you know, a white woman. Also, I used my pregnancy a number of times. I was pregnant at the time, during part of the time I was researching. But before I get to that, I had to appear in court in Alameda County in Oakland to deal with some charges. I was facing charges that she had incurred in a Whole Foods in Oakland, which was so strange that it was in my actual neighborhood I used to live in. So it was the Whole Foods I was accustomed to going to, and was right down the street from where I used to live before I moved to Albuquerque. So it was all very surreal. And what struck me after I got the charges dismissed, and again, it's really important that I acknowledge that I was able to get the charges dismissed, having been able to fly to Oakland to stand in court and be dressed nicely and present as a white woman to the judge and explain my circumstance and situation clearly. So that ended up resulting in the charges being dismissed. But then after that, I started to get really mad because I was just like fielding all of these calls and letters and summons and all kinds of like things where I was in real trouble because this woman had used my identity to do whatever she was doing. And so that's what drove me initially to start to try to find her. So I consulted with a private investigator, Pete Siragusa, who's now retired, and he helped me out for free for a couple months, and I was able to follow her trail, but, you know, it was complicated and difficult, as I just mentioned, to try to track her down.
Photographed her throughout this time, and the project resulted in the documentation of this process?
Yeah, so then I ended up showing the work. I was finally able to get photographs with the help of the private investigator later, several years later. And the gallery offered to do a monograph and an exhibition. It was a big deal for me in my career. And so I hired the private investigator to help me. And so then when I showed the work, kind of caught on locally in San Francisco, a bunch of people interviewed me, showed up to the show. I was contacted by This American Life and The Today Show. Like, it just became this like sort of domino of like viral transmission throughout the world. And so that year in 2014 and 15, when I was exhibiting the work and then my book was published, I got a lot of attention around it. And something kind of occurred to me after doing all those interviews and talking to people over and over again about the story, telling the story over and over again, that what really fulfilled me about that process was the investigation part. And I think a lot of researchers can really, and artists are, you know, as researchers, as we know, are creative practitioners and researchers, you know, I think that we are all investigators to some level or some degree. And for me, my investigation was about my personal identity. And so this woman stealing my identity, like I couldn't have made that up better. You know, I actually had a mentor who, when I was giving a talk back at California College of the Arts, asked me if it was real. She pulled me aside. She's like, "Is this real or did you make this up?" because it's like just too perfect. And I was like, no, I didn't make it up. Ira Glass asked me point blank, like, did you make this up? Like, we need to ask because we're going to have fact checkers check this. I was like, no, it's real. Like, it's really real. Like, I couldn't make it up. So that brings me to what I'm doing now, which is working on the screenplay of the story. Collaborating with an actor in LA on writing a story so she could play the part of me. And between now and when the project, you know, went viral was a whole period of several years of really busting my ass, like working really hard to learn the actual legit skill to be a private investigator. And so that project was called DIYPI, Do-It-Yourself Investigation, which really came out of Dear Aaron Hart and out of No Trespassing, which was the project about my father. And then,
and I love the way that sounds, DIYPI. I don't think you can, that's a word you can pronounce, but I love the way that sounds. So then, this is the evolution of your work. What's happening right now? How does that tie into what's currently going on?
Well, so I really was just consumed in 2016, 2017 with getting my license. I needed 6,000 hours to get 6,000 hours of investigative work to be signed off and proven. So I had to actually get the galleries that were able to secure the grants to pay me to do this work, pay me retroactively to do this work. I had to get them to sign off on a certain amount of hours that it took to do those projects. And then on top of that, that was only
because those counted towards your license.
Those counted towards my license. And I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to get that to happen, but I was able to get it happen. But even so, I was just shy of 3,000 hours, believe it or not, with those galleries signing off. And so I had to do the work, right? I had to show up and track down people's missing cats, track down lost packages. One of my first cases was finding a missing person that ended up turning into this whole drama of a divorce and then surveillance job. And then from there, you know, I'm up to, I think, client 86 or something. Like, I've had a number of repeat clients come back to me. Many people find me not through the actual, like, art piece at all. Like, most of my clients are actually, like, from either This American Life or locally. I'm known with lawyers. I have a lot of friends who are lawyers, and so they'll refer me. So I got those hours by just doing that work,
doing the work.
So I did a lot of private, or I did a lot of service of process. I still do service of process. Tracking people down all over the country, lots of different kinds of cases led to my license and then continues. So I have this culminating exhibition that I thought would happen, like, okay, I got my license and this is the end of the project. But it wasn't that simple. It was like, oh, this is the start of this work. This is the beginning. And so that's kind of, I'm in it now. I'm continuing to do that private investigation work. While being an educator, raising a kid, I go out at night to do surveillance jobs. I kind of live this sort of double, triple life. So the triple part is the art part, you know, and so that's kind of where I'm at now, is trying to resolve and working on what pieces of these client stories, or what part of my actual work as an investigator can I make art that's public? What can I reveal in an interview like this, you know? Because there's a lot of juicy stuff that I learn and that I go through the process of investigating all kinds of things. But what can I really share publicly? And so that's the sort of process I'm in right now. The piece that I share publicly that I'm working on is making a series of self-portraits of myself in different disguises that I've employed in my work, especially in surveillance. So showing up to a bar to try to surveil a guy who is a known rapist. So that is one true case that I had that I'm working on, the different disguises I employed to try to follow him and catch him in the act of being a perpetrator, which was complicated, you know.
That sounds extremely complicated and really kind of scary. So in this case, the art is you photographing or documenting your your work as an investigator through the disguises that you you're wearing.
Right.
Is that correct?
So that's that. Yeah. So that's where I've come to in the last year or so. I should mention on a personal note that right after I got my license, my mother passed away pretty suddenly in a really tragic accident that we're pursuing right now as a case of negligence on the part of the company that was transporting her to a doctor appointment. It's very complicated, but it's sort of something that I couldn't make into a case. I didn't want to make into a case, you know, I didn't want to make art out of. So that
right.
really put me in a place of like a holding pattern with my art. So it's been 2 years since that happened. And since then, I've really been able to ruminate and kind of think about in that space of like grieving and just doing nothing or seemingly nothing productive. And actually this idea of the self-portraits really came to me through that process. And then as I'm working on that, the This American Life re-aired a couple of months ago, I guess now, and lots of new clients have reached out to me through that. So not that it's meant to be a marketing strategy at all, but I think people are fascinated by the story and by the empathy that I exhibit in my investigations, because I know a lot of PIs now, and they're great at what they do, but what I'm bringing to it is this empathy of like understanding the story that led to the person needing an investigator. So the juicier cases I get are often like estrangement, a missing person, proving someone's doing something, you know, and I try to avoid like cut and dry sort of cheater cases that my mentor, Pete Siragusa, called them cheater cases. He's like, avoid those. And I do. But there's some that are really interesting that someone's committing a wrong against someone else and they want to kind of prove it. So all of those.
Then why avoid the cheater cases?
Well, because, you know, if a partner is cheating on their partner, if you think your partner's cheating on you, they probably are. Like, if you're going to hire a private investigator to try to figure that out, chances are you've got a pretty strong sense that that's happening. And then when the private investigator brings the proof to you, that's not the happiest moment, right, in their day and their life. And so having a tangible proof that this is happening doesn't always go very well for the investigator.
Right.
Because it's a lot
and that's
like
the most satisfying case end. Right, right.
Yeah, and it's a sad thing to explore. And I've done a couple, and they've been real sad, like really sad. And you don't like – I don't like delivering that information to my client because I care about them when I've talked to them and interviewed them. Whenever I interview a potential client, I always try to find out the most important question for me is like, why do you want this information and what do you want to do with it? And those cases, a lot of times it's like, well, I want to know so that I can figure out what to do. It's like, okay. But why do you really want it? Like, what are you actually going to do? You know, is this actually going to help your life? Like, do you already know the information, or do you really want to spend hundreds or thousands of dollars? And so,
right.
Oftentimes, I get to a place where obviously it's clear that the person is doing what they think they are, and either it'll go a couple different ways. They'll just be delusional about it and be like, no, keep going, or they'll be like, really sad, you know, that this is for real happening.
So the work you're doing now, I mean, just a snapshot of the past few years since your mother's passing, and I'm sorry to hear that. And in this accident, in this way, that's it sounds like, because this certainly happened to me as well. I mean, that didn't happen to me, but mother passing put a pause on things, right?
Yeah, I do.
It kind of stops everything, especially with a child and everything else, which is what the situation I was in. It kind of puts a pause on everything. So, but at the same time, your art you know, which I think is really fine, right? It's allowed in the art world. It's all part of the process. You know, if I can say that, your art evolved into this vocation that arguably is still your art, whether you're documenting it in an artistic way or not, or am I pushing it too much? Is it, I mean,
no, you know, you're validating the question that I've been, you know, you being pretty close to a stranger, validating the personal question that I've been struggling with. Grappling, thinking about, considering, in the headspace of trying to make clarity. I have the privilege of being able to make space in my life to have clarity. Like, I have the privilege of being paid by an educational institution to do a job that I can do and grieve, and or take time off if I need to, and have the space to read, to think, to process. That's not something we all are given, and especially when you're much younger. And capitalism doesn't, you know, allow that. You don't stop. You have a baby, you don't stop. You have a passing of a loved one, don't stop. You got to keep going. Got to get that hustle going, and especially for creative people, and especially for creative people outside of an institution. And there's lots more people now who are creative and are doing creative work that are not under the umbrella, under the protection, or under the, you know, and you could see it a couple different ways, right? Sometimes it's a burden, but there is a privilege that comes with that. And so I think in the past couple of years, I've been able to write a few grant proposals and rethink how I'm doing this project. And so that grieving really for me was a gift. It was a gift that opened this chasm, this space of like darkness, but also the fruitful darkness, as Joan Halifax puts it, the fruitful darkness of contemplation, of facing some of my fears, and being able to say no to some of the cases that have come up recently around COVID, around white supremacy. I've been working on a very, very undercover secret sort of research about white supremacy, and I can't talk about the details, but I can say I have had to stop. I have had to stop pursuing it because it's scary. It's scary to the point of like, I know now where my barrier is. I know as a mother, as a teacher, as an artist, like as just my own human, where my limit needs to be. And we only find that by facing those limits, you know? And I think a lot of us as researchers, practitioners, educators, parents, you know, you name it, the role you play in your own life, that's our responsibility to figure that out. But we're not often given the space and time to think that through. So that's where the grieving was able to feed into. Now, hopefully I'll be able to, now that COVID is here, now that the pandemic is here, it's a little harder to make work because I don't have access to the institutional, you know, space, the physical building and all that. But I have problem solving skills, you know, beyond measure, and I'll figure that piece out. And meanwhile,
yes, you will.
Meanwhile, I'm working with collaborating on the very baby steps beginning. We're just signing the contract and starting to come up with a timeline of how to write this story. So, you know, you've taken on the task of interviewing me about this story that isn't linear, as you can tell. And so we're trying to figure out how to tell that story visually in a sort of a movie docu fictional adaptation.
The story of the whole span of time that we've discussed today?
No, it doesn't cover the entirety. It starts at the end of No Trespassing. It starts with what I started with, which is funny that I started with that this time, with me installing the show about my father. And then it goes through to the end of when I finally found her and then documented her and had that work shown publicly. So it's sort of like bookends.
Right.
Yeah. It's pretty exciting.
Well, Jessamyn, that is exciting. So that project sounds great, and obviously is also a big part of what's happening now. It's wonderful talking to you about this, and especially, you know, as you were saying there, how grieving fits into this whole process, which is very powerful to hear, and the artistic questions that brings up. I want to ask you one more question, which is a nice question, and off topic, but what are you reading at the moment?
Well, it's kind of not off topic because I'm actually reading a couple different books. And so there's three that I can mention that'll be helpful to like providing a sense of my mind space, my head spaces. Pema Chodron's Living Beautifully with Uncertainty and Change is always kind of like a good one for me to go back to. So I'm rereading that. And I'm making my way over a long period of time. It's been like a couple years. I've been plugging away at Sacred Economics by Charles Eisenstein. And it talks a lot about the possibilities of capitalism and how can we not entirely dismantle it, but work within it and sort of rethink it and rethink money and sort of the sacred quality that we've established in our culture with money. And then, of course, I'm reading The Alphabet Mysteries by Sue Grafton. And so for anyone who's interested in private investigation, who likes noir, it's an excellent series. It's a series of novels that follow the alphabet. So each one, right now I'm reading I is for Innocent. And so the protagonist is Kinsey Malone, who's early 30s, I think, female private investigator living near L.A.
That's great. I like that. Thanks so much for mentioning those books. And thanks for talking to me today about your work and past projects and situation. Jessamine, thanks so much for talking with me today.
Well, it's been absolutely my pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.